All right. So whether you've been coaching for 50 years or 1 year, it can be really easy to fall into the trap of looking at today's players, today's athletes, and comparing today's athletes to the athletes from 5, 10, 15 years ago. To look at today's sporting landscape, you know, the culture, and complain. Now, if you do this frequently, right? Frequently, I mean, we're all going to do it at some point, but if you're one that frequently complains to your fellow coaches, you're complaining on social media, you're complaining to friends and family, my question for you is, why are you still coaching? No, that's not actually it. But my question really is, how is that working out for you? How is all that complaining working out for you? How is that serving you? How is complaining about today's athletes serving your team? My guess is it's not serving you very well. Today, we're back with Bob Starkey, who has served 45 years as an assistant coach in NCAA Division I. He is going to share a lot of practical advice on how to evolve and adapt as a coach, especially to today's coaching environment. He's going to discuss player brands, to player roles, getting players to buy into their roles, to accountability with players. It's quite a wide range of topics, but here's the most important thing that I think every one of us should take away from this conversation with Bob, and it is this: Bob's attitude. Bob's attitude is the very most important thing. It's not so much the strategy or methods that he shares here. The thing that impresses me the most about Bob is he's not sitting around complaining. He is learning, growing, adapting, and most importantly, he's bettering himself. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast, the podcast to help you grow as a leader and build a better culture. My name is JP Nurban, and I'm joined by my friends and co-host Nate Sanderson and Betsy Butterick. In addition to this podcast, I'm a leadership coach and culture consultant. To learn more about how my business, TOC, can support you and your team, visit tocculture.com. To learn more about Betsy, go on over to betsybutterick.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the TOC newsletter. Every Thursday, we send you a short article as well as the notes to every episode of the podcast. That way you don't crash the car trying to take notes while you're driving. You'll also receive the top 10 podcast episodes of the Coaching Culture Podcast and my top 10 articles when you subscribe to the newsletter. So you can subscribe using the link in the description of this episode or simply by going on over to tocculture.com and clicking on newsletter.
Well, I want to ask you this question here. We talked a little bit about building culture and the importance of that and how relationships are certainly baked into that, but so are values and standards. And in today's world, I don't care if you're at the college level, the high school level, with so much mobility where players can play for one team their freshman year and then another team. And, you know, there's so much movement and so much player empowerment. And I know sometimes that phrase gets a negative connotation, and I don't mean it that way at all. But it's a bit different world. And I've been doing this for 20 years, and there's more mobility at the high school level now than there's ever been, even here in Iowa. So when it comes to fighting for those standards and those values and establishing those in an identity as a program, how do you go about doing that with just the amount of change that happens so quickly in today's game?
Well, that's a great question. It's probably an evolving question. You know, I was having a conversation with one of my colleagues, and if you're going to stay in this business for a long time and have success, you better be able to evolve and change. There's nothing more important. But for the longest time, those changes have been incremental. And the last 3 or 4 years, they have been massive. And I mean, warp speed, and it's we've never seen anything like this. And there's no manual. I go back to Buzz Williams, who said, you know, in this day and age, you better coach with your head on a swivel. You better. There's two ways you can go about this. You can be one of those coaches who gripe and complain about the portal or the NIL, or you can be one of those coaches who embrace it and put it to work for you. And I think that's the way it has to be. It doesn't do any good for you to complain. That really doesn't solve the problem. So I think if you truly care about your student athletes, then you wholeheartedly embrace change. I'll give you an example with the NIL situation. So we're fortunate enough to win a national championship, and we've got several players on our team with great NIL opportunities. I mean, some really huge NIL opportunities to travel, to go to places, to do photo shoots, to shoot ads, to do all this. And so Kim gave them the first session of summer school off. The guys, go chase this opportunity. Go live this dream. I don't know. We're here for you. We actually have a member. This is, again, this is Coach Malky. We have a member on our staff whose sole job is NIL maintenance. I mean, she's there to navigate with kids. She helps them with their deals, make sure they understand the language, understands about law, taxes, the whole nine. Now, this is how you invest in kids. This is how kids know that Kim cares about them beyond being a player. And so she gives them this month to go out. A lot of coaches wouldn't do that. No, we're here. Basketball. We got to lift weights. We got to get the individual workout. So I think if you truly care about young people, sometimes it's the coaches that have to make the sacrifice and not the student athletes. And I think that can be tough sometimes. You know, I go way back. I was from the generation to, this is us, this is how we do it, no exceptions, blah, blah, blah. I don't think you can be that way anymore. And I'm not saying our way is 100% correct. I mean, I think we're going to be a case study 10 years from now in how we handled NIL and portal and everything. And, you know, Lute Olson said something about, if you really want to judge a recruiting class, come back 20 years later. And then I'll tell you what kind of recruiting class that was. And I think it's going to take time before we know if we're doing the right things. But what I know in my heart is we're doing it for the right reasons. We're trying to help these kids capitalize on opportunities that they never had before. Some of them have been life altering for them.
Bob, talk, if you will, about back in the day, even if we just focus on women's basketball, let's say, when a student athlete committed to a program, the program was the brand, right? So historically, we think of the Tennessees, the UConns, the Stanfords, whatever it happens to be, that was the brand. And playing for a good brand gave you visibility, gave you opportunities for exposure. Now with NIL, you have almost all these micro brands within the label of a program or a parent brand, so to speak. Talk to me about culture and how you co-create the value of a program. We know co-creation is huge for Gen Z. They want to have a say in how things go. What does that look like for you as a coach today between these are the values of our program versus, or in partnership with, these are the values of an individual's brand, and how do we get those to find a meeting place?
Well, I think you gave the answer in your question. The absolute most important is you have to let the student athlete have a seat at the table. They have to be involved in that process. You know, I tell this question all the, I tell a story all the time. My first time running through LSU, I was at LSU for 25 years, worked for the late great Hall of Fame Sue Gunner. And the football coach at that time was a guy named Nick Saban here at LSU. And Nick Saban's very, very process oriented. What that means, he's not in to goals that are numerical or his thing is, I want to have the next best possession. They don't ever talk about winning. They don't talk about national championships. They don't talk about conference championships. Their goal is about dominating their opponent on the next play. And if you are locked in and you're pouring all your energy into the next play, that's your best chance of success. If you're thinking about winning, that takes away from your concentration level on this play. And, you know, he told me to the standpoint that, in games and practices, he only had two players that were allowed to look at the clock, his quarterback and his defensive captain, because it didn't matter if you were up 10, down 7, tied, first quarter, third quarter, fourth quarter, if it was second and 10, first, it didn't matter. The only thing that mattered was the play. And so he came and spoke to our team one year. We had just came from the Elite Eight, and we had a great segment of those players coming back, and he talked to our kids about the process, about living in the moment, not having destinational goals. You know, don't worry about how many games you win. Don't worry about this. Don't worry about that. And so as Coach Gunner always did, she brought the kids in and she would let the kids set the goals for the season. She said, we can set the goals and it sounds good and we can put it on a card and in the notebook, but buy-in comes from them having a part of that process. So she told the team that she wanted them to come up with the goals for that season. And a week later, Tamika Johnson, our captain, came in and said, we're ready, Coach. We got one goal. And my heart just sunk. I just thought she's going to say Final Four, national championship. But she said, we want to be the best practice team in the country. I'm like, uh-oh, she got it. She was listening to Nick. She got it. So then Coach Gunner, obviously higher level intelligence than me, said, I love that goal, but here's what I need you to do. I need you to go back and meet with your team and tell me, how are we going to evaluate that? How are we going to grade that? What does a good practice look like? How can every day, can we come back, join in our circle and say, well, were we the best practice team in the country? Why or why wouldn't we? And that team went to the Final Four and started a run of 5 straight Final Fours. So I think allowing players to have not just the voice, but the power to be part of the decision is critically important, more important than ever before, because we do have a brand here at LSU, a standard, a culture, but we also acknowledge and support the brand of the players. And we actually try and weave those together. And I think that's the only way you can do it in this day and age of individual. You know, we have players that have attorneys, that have marketing firms, that have, I mean, they, you know, it's a different world out there. So they have to see the win-win. And certainly you recruit the right kids. And that, you know, John Gooden talks about all the time, drive your own bus, but the most important thing is to put the right people on your bus. Well, the first thing we do when we meet with our kids each year is we talk about what's the number one thing you want to accomplish here. And that's to win at the highest level. Let's be honest, winning at the highest level makes my administration happy, makes the fans happy. It fulfills my goals. But guess what? It helps each individual with their brand. You know, when you see things out there that are marketed, it's from players on winning teams, not players from teams that are unsuccessful. So when we talk about what does that look like, and it always comes back to work ethic, attitude, condition. You know, again, I go back to Tim Elmore. We're selling bottled water. We're selling the same things we've always sold. We just got to tie them in a little differently to let the kids know that, yes, this will benefit you too.
I love this visual of we're selling bottled water, and yet I'm visualizing all the water bottles looking different because of all the different personalities and you know, the brand identities of your athletes. I want to come back to you because I think it's so important and it relates to one of the challenges that we face with today's student athletes. You're talking about that next possession, right? Or being the best practice team, really living in the moment. And I hear coaches of all sports saying, you know, I really want my players to be present. I want them to be where their feet are. We know that long-term success comes from that kind of presence. And again, I was looking through your social media and you had a passage from the Daily Stoic about pretend today is the end. How, as a coach, do you help offer that perspective to today's student athlete, knowing that so much of their focus or attention is on future results?
I think it's absolutely constant repetition in your messaging and the way you conduct your practice. By the way, I think practice is the singularly most important part of developing your culture. How you run your practice. I think the way coaches work through their day, I think terminology is important. You know, one of the things we got from Don Meyer, you know, we want our players to be an NBA player. NBA stands for next best action. And we are constantly pushing that concept. You know, if a player makes a mistake in practice, I'm yelling NBA, NBA, next best action. We'll show examples on film of a player turning the ball over, but coming back and making a great play on offense or defense and saying, hey, that's the way to stay in the moment. There was, and I'm a big believer in using video. There was in the Last Dance deal with Michael Jordan, Phil Jackson said his singularly most greatest power is that he was always present. It wasn't that he could jump this high, that he was this quick, that he was always present. Now, we showed that clip to our players. We talked about that. Do you know how amazingly difficult it was for Michael Jordan to be always present? I mean, we're talking about the singularly most visible human being on the earth when they were making that run. Yet he had the ability to concentrate and focus. The other part I think that sometimes gets lost in this is people think, you know, certainly you don't want to let a mistake lead to another mistake, but this generation sometimes doesn't handle success very well. And I think our basketball team went through that. We came off a national championship in our first game this year. We go to Vegas and play Colorado, and we get it handed to us. We did not handle success very well. And that's part of next best action. You know, how many times do you see a player make a great play and they're celebrating instead of getting back on defense? I talk about practice. We have a drill at practice called the kill drill. For us, kills are three consecutive stops. You have, and they have to be perfect stops. So it doesn't matter if the team that you're competing against, we got scrimmage guys, misses the shot. We better have jumped to the ball. We better gotten over the screen. We better been in stance. All five players been talking. If we don't do all that, we start back at zero, and we won't in practice. There was one time at Texas A&M, we did the kill drill for 45 minutes. We were at you better be present in this possession. So I think creating examples, visual examples, physical examples, I'm a big believer in this, and I think young coaches need to hear this. You have to celebrate the behavior you want repeated. Most everybody thinks coaching is losing your mind when a mistake's made, you know. But the thing I like about Kim can be very direct and pointed when you make a mistake. But she is loud and nuts when you do something great. And to me, that's one of the underrated parts of teaching, is celebrating good play. And then if I could go one step further, you're communicating of that good play. So let's say Sally makes a good pass into the post. Telling Sally good pass does no good. Sally may have made a good pass by accident. So what you do, hey, Sally, way to throw the ball away from the defense to that outside knee. Now you've complimented her and you've given her something to go back. By the same token, telling Sally, that's a bad pass. That's not teaching. That's not teaching at all. My wife could tell you it's a bad pass. Sally, you got to make sure you throw the ball away from the defense. You threw it on the inside right there. That's teaching. So your terminology and how you go about teaching, whether it's correcting or complimenting, is very important if you want that action repeated or not repeated, if that makes sense.
One of the great things that another friend of ours on the podcast here, Will Ray, has shared, and I've seen this in action in some of his practices, is tying the values of the program or of the team to the behaviors or the actions that happen in a game. And so one of the big things in their program is deflections. And so they have a team rule. You get a deflection on defense. At the next dead ball, everybody's getting in touch with that guy. You know, we're celebrating them, you know, going above and beyond, right? And their defensive activity. Are there other things in practice? Because I think sometimes as coaches, you know, we're in the heart of the season here too. We think, well, we're getting ready for our next opponent. And that tends to dominate our thinking when it comes to scouting and pregame and preparing. Yet you're telling me here that practice is really the number one place where culture is driven. What else is it about practice, or what opportunities are there in practice for us to drive culture that maybe sometimes we miss when we just get caught up in the day-to-day grind?
Well, I'll go back to my mentor, the late, great Don Myers. Sometimes it's not what you teach, it's what you emphasize. So for us, we start every practice the same way. The first 20 minutes, we're doing a low post feed series, and we're putting pressure on the passer, and it's very physical down there for the post players. And very demanding. It's a very demanding, but if we practice 101 times last year, which we did, 101 times we started with that drill. We're a post feed, we're a paint team, and we're going to drive that home to start the day every day. So I think each team has certain standards and how they play, I think, is a part of your identity. I'll give you a story I like to tell, and, you know, coming on the heels of his passing, but I grew up in West Virginia. My junior high coach that I referred to earlier was a Bob Knight guy. I mean, in junior high, we played motion offense, man-to-man defense, wore the candy stripe, warm-up pants even. But we went to, when I first started coaching, I went to a one-man Bob Knight clinic in Cincinnati, Ohio. I'm sorry, Columbus, Ohio. And it's a day-and-a-half clinic, and at the end, there's questions. And so if you know anything about Indiana Bob Knight, he played 100% man-to-man for 1,000 years, however long he coached, and nobody played it better. That was and it was how they played it. We're going to be hard-nosed, we're going to be tough, and we're going to be disciplined. And that was who they were defensively. So this young high school coach raised his hand up, and he said, "Coach Knight, what do you think is the best zone defense to play?" And Knight looked at him and said, "Well, we don't believe in zone defense in Indiana. We believe in the individual responsibility of guarding people through man-to-man defense." So Knight takes a few more questions, and the same coach raises his hand. And, you know, everybody's kind of chuckling a little bit. Now he says, "Coach, I know you're a big man-to-man guy, but if you were going to play a zone, which zone would it be?" And Knight said, "I wouldn't play any of them. I don't like any of them." He takes a few more questions. Guys, I promise, same guy. Now, we're on the edge of our seats, and I'm going to clean this up for the audience, but Knight just kind of glares at him a while and says, "What?" He said, "Coach, if the NCAA passed a rule that you had to play zone defense, what would it be?" And Knight said, I'd freaking quit. Now, don't raise your hand again. And obviously, we all got a big laugh, but that's who they are. You talk about a standard. We're Indiana basketball. Our coach will quit before he plays zone. So I think how you play the game says a lot about your culture. You know, you ask anybody about Kim Mulkey's team, they're going to play hard, they're going to get the ball inside, and they're going to rebound. Well, guess what we work on in practice a lot? We work on those three things. So I think you have to, as a coach, define what your identity is, and then you have to explain to your kids why that identity is so important. I tell you why the identity is so important, because games are won in the paint and rebounds mean extra possessions, guys. And I think when you do that, I think your culture can come forth through your practice, your regimentation, your drill selection, all those kinds of things. I do think there's also, you know, I want to hit on this. I think it's really important with culture. And I actually posted something a couple of days on Gino about being the best you can be at your role. And I don't think there's anything more important in culture than defining roles for every single player on that team and creating importance for every single role. We had Simone Augustus, the leading scorer in the country. Her role was to get open and make shots. We had another player, Wendland Jones, whose role was to run down the floor every time, find Simone Augustus, and get her open. So what we did, you know, we chart deflections. That's very important. But in those days of running motion offense, we charted screens. It was important to us, and we wanted to make sure the players knew. So we had a category that said most screen set, screens that led to scores. And then in film sessions, we would show the screen. So we might show a Winland setting a down screen, Simone curling and hitting the shot. And then we go back and we show Winland setting the screen. We wouldn't get to the part where Simone shot it. Well, guys, do you understand? Simone doesn't get, look at the angle, look at her sprint. Look how she got her right there. That screens everything. So guess what happens halfway through the season? Simone's in a press conference, said, "Would you like to talk about dropping 32 tonight?" Said, "I sure would." Said, "You see how many screens Winland Jones set for me?" And so Winland Jones comes back her senior year, first team meeting, and walks around and passes out business cards, says, "Winland Jones, professional screener." So we all got a big kick out of that, obviously, but it also said, hey, we made that connection. So last year, one of the absolute most important players on our team was a walk-on named Emily Ward, who at practice, at games, was the biggest cheerleader you ever saw. Took pride in making sure she lifted players that were down. Kim Mulkey took her to the press conference a couple of times. Sometimes Kim's in the press conference. So you have to define roles. Then you have to communicate those roles to the players where they absolutely understand without question what those roles are. They have to understand their teammates' roles. And then you have to apply importance to every one of those roles. The last thing about roles that I'll say is let players know that they're not locked into that role. Okay, Winland, your job screening. If you continue to work on your ability to shoot, if you continue to work on your ability to post, seal, drop step, then guess what? Your role is going to expand. We're going to give you that opportunity. But the best cultures I have been a part of have been the ones that have put attention to detail and to creating roles and creating importance for them.
And that specificity, right? Like, this is your role, so that someone can then take pride in being great, sure, or exceptional at that role. Crucially important. And I think about across sport, especially in basketball, when you have, let's say, a coach that has committed to, with Bob Knight commitment, you know, a positionless offense where all the players are interchangeable, we're going to create havoc for the defense, where roles aren't as clearly defined, what would you recommend for even the players about how to go about establishing roles within the culture of their team?
Well, I do think in terms of that, like when I was at LSU, my first 12 years of women's basketball, we ran Bob Knight's motion offense. And even with that, you had, you know, you were a screener, you were a passer, you were a cutter. Now, if you were a screener, after you screened, you got to make what we called a second cut. The better you screen, the more opportunity you got to get a touch and to get a score. There has to be, I think when you're talking about offense, some hierarchy, some level of this is what you do first, this is what you do second, and everybody has to know. You know, you're a feeder, you're a screener, you're a cutter. Doesn't mean you don't get to do the other things, but you have to know first and foremost for our offense to work. You have to excel in one or two of these areas.
Well, Bob, I want to ask you this question. In our work with coaches, and again, we're working with high school and college coaches both, I think more and more today, coaches are sometimes operating from a place of fear when it comes to holding players accountable to the standards or accountable to the roles that are defined for them. And, you know, there's lots of reasons for that. Obviously, the ability to move and the influences of others, you know, on our players, et cetera. But what advice would you give to our, you know, high school head coaches and assistant coaches when it comes to just fighting for that culture and fighting for those standards every day?
The first thing, those standards have to be absolutely clearly defined. And I'm a big believer in, if your culture is not written on a piece of paper, I don't know how strong it is. And again, you have to fight for it every day. So, those standards better be clearly defined, and they need to be talked about almost on a daily basis, whether it's through practice. You know, that I can't, the absolute most amazing thing about Kim Mulkey, because I'm a student of the game. So I came here to LSU for my second tour duty, obviously to come back home, but to watch how she does things. And her messaging in practice is phenomenal. And it'll be nothing for her to sprinkle in something that happened in practice and tie it to one of our standards. So they just have to be, and I know I'm beating this hard, but it has to be clearly defined and continually repeated. And then the next thing, it has to be handled fairly. It has to be handled fairly. You don't suspend a kid that is a kid that comes off the bench and plays 5 minutes for something and then give a starter a slap on the hand. Now, that doesn't mean there's not some parameters involved there. You know, years ago, we had a kid that was struggling to do what she needed to do academically, had missed some classes, had missed some study hall. We tried a couple of other things. And finally, I'm meeting with our head coach, and I said, I think we have to take basketball away from her for a little bit, whether it's a week or 2 weeks. But I think we have to find a way to get her attention to understand that that school is why she's here first. And so we did that. And a couple of weeks later, the coach called me and said, we got another problem, said we got another kid that missed the study hall. Well, that kid had like a 3.8 GPA and had no prior missings. I said, well, we don't need to, you know, they have made deposits and the bank account, you know, and I think that's important. What Kim does really good when it comes to holding people accountable is she explains to our team what she's doing and why she's doing it. So there's no questions. There's no, well, why is she, why is she in, you know, she's very open and communicative with the team. Also, again, sometimes in terms of accountability and discipline, there's just not one set way to do things. I think Nick Saban once said the goal of discipline is change behavior. So what are you doing in terms of discipline that will change behavior for that player? It may not always be a suspension. May not be always sitting them on the bench. I think you have to be open-minded to all the various forms of getting a player's attention to try and help them to do the right thing. And I think that's one of the hard things for coaches today, right? Because it's so many kids are different. There's so many things out there. Kids don't feel empowered. They are empowered. They are empowered. You know, Gino made the comment last summer that there are a lot of young coaches who are afraid of holding kids accountable because they think they're going to jump in the portal, and they probably will. My thing is, if you feel strong enough about your standards and your culture, you do what's right. And if they leave, then they didn't need to be there to begin with. And that's why I love working about Kim. Kim will tell them up front, this place isn't for everybody. We're going to hold you to a standard here, both on the court and off the court. If that works, you're going to leave here a better player and a better person. And if it doesn't work, then you probably need to find someplace else because you're probably not going to be happy here. Now, that's an easy thing for Kim to say. She's won 4 national championships. She could lose a couple of players and not lose her job. And to me, it's the biggest challenge in coaching. For it, our job should be, you know, again, Don Meyer, it doesn't matter where you coach, it matters why you coach. Our number one purpose in coaching should be to impact young people in the communities we live in. Well, guess what? We can't do that unless we win. Because if we don't win, we don't get to stay there. So you got to temper it sometimes. But when you don't hold somebody accountable, then, you know, it's a different kind of culture. I tell people all the time about culture. Your program has a culture. You may not have dictated it. You may not have defined it, but, you know, not having standards is a culture. So it's the most difficult thing that we do right now, I think, is maintaining a culture with all the major evolutionary changes that are going on in collegiate athletics right now. But I still think you have to hold true to who you are. And, you know, like Kim will tell you, you know, if I can't hold a kid accountable, if we can't continue to build a team, then it's time for me to go to the house.
Well, I got 2 more. We'll get you out of here. You've been in the business for a while. I'm sure you've had dozens and dozens of opportunities to take that seat to the left, you know, one place or another here and move up the chain and have your own team. And yet you've remained in that assistant coach's position. And I'm just curious as to, you know, coaches go through this all the time, the opportunity to move up, to move down, to move over, you know, one way or the other. How have you kind of thought through that? And what has it been for you that's caused you to stay an assistant coach here for most of your career?
I always thought it's what I did best. The things that are involved in being an assistant coach, the individual development of players, watching film, doing scouts, all those things that being a practice coach, all the things that I just thought that was my strength. I joke around. There was a line in a Clint Eastwood movie one time where Clint said, a man's got to know his limitations. And I think, you know, we talked about owning your role. I think this is my role, and I've had some opportunities, but the longer I do it, the more I feel like this is where I belong. And the more I'm working for, you know, I've been doing this for 44, 45 years, and I've worked for 4 Naismith Hall of Fame coaches. Think about that. I've worked for 4 Naismith, and I'm working for Kim, and I'm like, I'm nowhere close to being what a head coach would be like Coach Malky. So I just think it's what I do best, and it's what I enjoy. I also think being an assistant coach is probably the ideal servant leader. I mean, we serve our kids, we serve our head coach, and it's just a role I've enjoyed. And again, I've been blessed to work for some amazing people.
Well, I want to get you out of here on this. You are a avid, committed, lifelong learner. It's one of the things that I just am so impressed with, your constant sharing on social media, your willingness to invest in coaches at clinics and hopping on calls like this and doing podcasts like this. What is it about just continuing to learn and being so devoted to personal development that you find so important kind of in your role here?
Well, two things. The first one, it's rejuvenating to me. When I listen to a podcast, go to a clinic, go visit with a coach, I'm a voracious reader. I love reading. I mean, all those things, they energize me. But the one thing I've learned the longer I've coached is I don't know enough. I don't know enough. I mean, I get so excited when I go to a clinic or visit with a coach or read something and come up with one thing that I think can make our program better. I mean, holy cow, that's a good day right there. I mean, that's a good day. You know, people I'll go to a coaching clinic and somebody will say, you know, I didn't think so-and-so was very good. And I'll say, yeah, but what about that one point he made about how he handles a timeout coming off a bad play? That's all I need. It does. It rejuvenates me, and there's nothing more exciting than being able to grab a nugget that'll make me better as a person or a teacher or a coach, or really if I could find something to help my players. And I also think, and I just, again, in terms of helping our players grow, it's one thing I always preach. Like, we give our kids books to read. You know, let me tell you what our kids don't like is we'll come up with a daily quote with a thought for our kids. And, you know, it may come from, I don't know, let's just say George Patton. And, you know, Kim will ask somebody, says, who here knows who George Patton is? And, you know, in this day and age, we'll have a lot of players who won't know. And I'll just jump in. I said, good. By tomorrow, I need a one-page report on who George Patton is. And so I think if you're a continual learner and, you know, I could literally do a podcast on what I've learned from Don Meyer. Your example is not the main thing. It's the only thing. And I love that. So I think if my kids see me constantly learning at this age, hopefully that's something they'll take away when they get off into their professional life, whatever that is. That, you know, hey, Coach Starkey made a good living by continuing to learn. Maybe I ought to try that. So maybe the third reason is as I like to think I'm setting a good example.
And Coach, knowing that you take pride in your role and hearing the passion that you have to be a lifelong learner, I have to ask, what's the most recent thing that you've learned?
This has been about a two-year process. Ryan Holiday, who is really into Stoicism and is a friend of Buzz Williams. Buzz brought him to Texas A&M to speak to his men's basketball team and was kind enough to let me sit in on it. It was the first time I got involved into Stoicism. And I've really been studying the heck out of it for 2 weeks. And you kind of alluded to something earlier, but the philosophy of memento mori, that we all must die. And understanding that concept will help you to live each single day in a much fuller way. I can't tell you, but matter of fact, one of the things I have here on my desk is a Ryan book that I read every day, The Daily Stoic. And there's a passage in there each day that usually smacks me right between the eyes. But just understanding my morality and that we don't know how much time we have has helped me to live. I have lived such a better life this past year from studying some of the things that Ryan has preached and the Stoicism. Just because we don't know. We don't know. And I think sometimes it's difficult for young people, but it's been difficult for people my age. So every day, you know, a lot of times when I post something, I'll use hashtag today matters. And I believe that with my whole heart and soul. Today is it, man. This is the day. We got what can we do today to make this the best day? And then if we're fortunate enough to wake up tomorrow, let's do it again.
Well, it's a powerful reminder here. And that's another thing I just appreciate so much about you is you're not just learning for yourself, but you're constantly sharing on social media? And just for our audience here, how can coaches follow your stuff and the things that you're sharing on social?
Well, that's a great question. I think my Twitter handle is Coach Bob Starkey. I know my Instagram is Hoop Coach Bob Starkey because I lost my account sometime and I had to change it so it doesn't match my Twitter account. But not toot my horn, but I do steal from the very, very best. But I do think that's if anybody that knows Don Meyer, whenever he went to his clinics, he had all these different cards and pass outs, and he was just a share of knowledge. And, one quick story, since he just got through passing, Bob Knight and Dean Smith were at a summer event, recruiting event. And they were just kind of sitting off by the side. Knowing them, they probably weren't paying attention to the game. They were talking basketball, but they were talking, motion offense. You know, Knight ran motion. Dean Smith ran passing game, which is the same way. And Knight said, you know, I wish I could get my guys to move better like you guys do. You guys, you space better. You cut to the rim better. And Dean started laughing. He said, that's funny because our staff was talking. He said, we wish we could screen better like you guys. You guys are better screeners than we are. And Knight says, you know, you need to come to Bloomington and we just need to sit in the film room for a couple of days. And Dean Smith said, I would love that. He said, well, we can't do it this year because we play each other. And Knight said, so come on up. Here's two guys are going to play each other, and they get together and they're sharing. The best way to grow this game is to share, period. No other way. I'm here where I am because people have invested and shared with me, plain and simple.
Wow, that was just absolutely incredible. I think what blows me away the most is just what an amazing human being Bob is. Obviously, he made some great points on how we need to work with players on their brands, adapting to today's, you know, culture, especially at the collegiate level. I love the points around co-creating with the players today. It's not just telling them how things are going to be or what we're trying to do here or the standards, but co-creating those standards definitely was speaking my language and really, you know, really connected with a lot of the things in the culture system. My book there where I talk about establishing and supporting the standards, Bob was really harping on how we have to have clearly defined standards and talking about them daily. Open communication on accountability with team. I think he mentioned that Kim does that well. And I think this is something coaches need to do a better job of, is having more transparency. I remember Eric Lang from American International College, you know, the hockey coach there, he talked about, you know, more transparency. I think coaches are hesitant to do that because they're afraid of, you know, they like to have these personal conversations. They don't feel like, well, that's not everybody's business on the team. But the reality is there's a lot of misunderstandings if we don't have transparency around the accountability that's going on within the team. So that's one great takeaway as well as to don't operate out of fear of holding players to standards. He talked about Kim's example as a head coach there of, you know, bottom line is this place may not be for you, right? You have to make a decision as a player whether you want to meet the standards or not. But probably the two biggest things that I absolutely love from this conversation is humility. And the humility and awareness that Bob has to recognize this is what I do best as being an assistant coach. And he's not sitting around thinking, oh, I can just do it better than the head coach. There's way too many assistant coaches that I have run into over the years that just sit around and think about how they can do it better than the head coach. And when we operate in that space, oftentimes it makes things very, very difficult for us as an assistant coach to find joy in that journey and to have as much of an impact as we can. And lastly, the big thing that he shared is just how he's been getting better as a person every single day. He's a reader. He's, you know, attends clinics. He's just constantly sharing his knowledge with the coaching community. And for that, I know we all appreciate Bob. Thanks for listening in to the Coaching Culture Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast. Leave us a review. We appreciate you leaving reviews. It helps us to spread the word around transformational culture and transformational coaching. Also, be sure to subscribe to the newsletter at tocculture.com, as well as, you know, when you're at that website, you can check out some of my books, The Culture System, The Sports Parent Solution, and our online training and certification program for coaches.